And I guess there's not much chance somebody's going to fall asleep at me at this hour, maybe. I'm going to teach 101 in an hour from now, so be bad. Okay, well, I'm going to talk a little bit about precipitation around here. And do I have a laser pointer someplace?
Do we have a laser pointer here?
Laser, right
no.
here.
No?
Here.
Right, let's see. Does that work? Okay, it's tied down here. Because people steal laser pointers here. Well, anyway, let's talk about water here. This is a water lecture, right? Few areas of the United States have as much precipitation and a gradient of precipitation as us in the Northwest. I mean, this shows you precipitation around the country. And look at that. I mean, we are unique. I mean, we're talking about values getting to 150, 180 inches a year. So there's something really different about where we are compared to other places. Just a little blow up here. Let's look at this map over here. On one side, you have the on one side of the Olympics here, you have like 150, 170 inches of rain a year. Right over here in Squim, they get about 15. I mean, that is absolutely startling, the kind of gradients of precipitation we have here. One of the number one questions I get from people from out of state, particularly from California, is it really true it's dry? It's how dry it is in Squim. All these people retiring there because of that. It's just an amazing difference in precipitation. And other places around here have the same thing. If you go down the Columbia Gorge, you go from heavy, you know, rainforest on this side and desert on the other, and you can drive this in a half an hour. Northwest precipitation has major societal impacts, and not the least of which are the dams and the water supplies that we have around here. And this year it's tremendously in the news, the Howard Hanson Dam and all the worries of the failure of that dam. The number one weather destruction mechanism in the Northwest are floods. And we have our collection of billion-dollar weather events, and they are floods. And, you know, this is, in effect, there were quite a few in the mid-90s, but here's 82, 83. But our big losses are floods. If this went up a little bit further, it would have had the one in 97, which was also a big one. Now, most of our heaviest precipitation comes from something that's colloquially known as the Pineapple Express, and really is kind of an amazing thing. Sometimes they're also called atmospheric rivers. And it's interesting that our big flood events are when we have these relatively narrow currents of moisture coming up from the tropics and subtropics. And they call it the Pineapple Express here because it's starting from near Hawaii. Now, it's both warm and wet. And it has to be warm because the air can't hold that much moisture unless it's warm. So it's this warm, moist current. And the amounts we can get are extraordinary. The last really major Pineapple Express was November 2006. And look at this. And this Hawaii down here. Look at that moisture plume. This is from a satellite that's looking down and measuring how much water vapor there is in the atmosphere. It's like Star Trek, right? And here it is coming right into us. This particular Pineapple Express caused extraordinary rains. This is November 6th to 9th, 2006. You probably may not be able to read the numbers very well. It's in millimeters. But the dark green is 20 inches of rain in one event. I mean, think about that, you know? At Mount Rainier National Park, they had 18 inches in 36 hours. And the devastation there was extraordinary. Roads taken out, you know, trails taken out. It was amazing. Now, you can't understand precipitation around here without knowing that terrain and local effects greatly modify the precipitation distribution. And, you know, this is insulting you maybe, but anyway, the key issue is this. You have terrain, and we have plenty of terrain here. If you have air approaching the terrain, there's upslope on one side and downslope on the other. Upslope, the air goes from high pressure to low pressure. As the air rises, it expands. And as you know, when air expands, it cools. It cools, and air that's initially unsaturated, it cools enough that it can just barely hold the moisture it starts out with. Push it up any further, you get clouds and precipitation. So you have, on the windward side, you get precipitation and clouds, but on the other hand, when it sinks on the other side, you have drying and warming. So lee side precipitation, windward precipitation, lee side drying is essential to what's going on around here. And, you know, you can see this if you look at the weather radar. Now, we have a weather radar. Weather radar shows where there's precipitation. We don't have one on the coast, but we have one at Caimano Island. And this is for a day when we had southwesterly flow. Now, you see this over there? It's raining like hell over there. But you can't see it because the radar beam from Caimano Island is being blocked. And some of you may know one of my little projects is to get a radar on the coast, which we will have in 2 years. Anyway, that is a rain shadow right there, right there. And we see that very frequently because in the wintertime, the predominant flow is from the southwest. Now, this is a simulation of this event. You know, I'll talk more about simulation later. This is simulated precipitation by a computer model, and this is 48 hours ahead, and look at that. You see that? There's a rain shadow for you, right? Heavy precipitation on one side, that's the red there and the black, and no precipitation there. That's one very important aspect of around here. Well, look at this. Western Washington, all this precipitation here. Eastern Washington, there's nothing. So gradients of precipitation are really major. The other thing is we have all these local weather effects that really affect precipitation, and none is more famous than the Puget Sound Convergence Zone. And this is something that you all experience here at the University of Washington many times. And the way it works is when the winds on the coast are from the west to the northwest. Okay, here's the Olympics over here. Here are we right there. Okay, the air goes through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, through the Chehalis Gap, and the air that is blocked by the Cascades, it converges over Puget Sound. And when you have air converging, you just can't do that forever. You start pushing air up. And so air is coming together. That's convergence zone. Air rises, giving you this area of clouds right over here. And that's the convergence zone. Look at that. It's clear to the south and to the north. So it's this really narrow band. And if you look at a weather radar, you can see convergence zones. It's right across the sound. It likes to be between Seattle and Everett. And it's only, 5-10 kilometers wide. So if you're in that pouring rain, you can get out of it by going north or south. The convergence zone effect extends into the mountains, and there's probably, heavy precipitation, snow in the mountains right over here, much less to the south and north. So that's an example of a local weather effect. Now, during the last decades, there has been major advances in understanding and predicting the precipitation over our region. And one of the most important tools is high-resolution numerical simulation. We can simulate the weather over our region, including precipitation. Now, this is numerical forecasting 101, okay? I'm authorized to tell you this because I'm a 101 teacher. But the technology we use for forecasting that underlines all forecasts is numerical simulation. And the way it works is we start with what we call an initialization. That is, meteorologists get all the observations available and create a three-dimensional description of the atmosphere. That's called the initialization. That's where we initialize our computer models. Then we use certain equations, equations that describe the physics of the atmosphere to predict the future. These are called the primitive equations. They're not primitive at all, but that's what we call them, the primitive equations. They start with the initialization, and then they're able to simulate the future. Generally, we solve these equations on a three-dimensional grid. Okay, the atmosphere is three-dimensional. You can imagine a three-dimensional grid. We solve it at the grid points. And the more grid points you have, the closer they are together, the better it is, right? That means more resolution. When we talk about these computer models, we talk about a resolution of 12 kilometers. That means the grid points are separated by 12 kilometers. Better to have a 4-kilometer resolution, right? The grid points are closer together. Okay, now computers have been getting faster and faster and faster, and that allows us to have more grid points, more resolution, and include more physics, more equations that describe the atmosphere. I mean, an example of this whole business is Newton's second law, right? Everybody knows about Newton's second law, right? Force is equal to mass times acceleration. Well, this equation is a time machine. Believe it or not. Because if we have all these observations, we have this initialization, we can figure out what all the forces are. That's not hard. Gravity, we can figure that one out. Pressure forces, we can figure that out. So we can figure out all the forces. Mass, well, we can figure that out. We're measuring how much air there is, no problem there. And that allows us to calculate acceleration. Acceleration is a change in velocity and time. If you know the velocity now and you have the acceleration, you can figure out what the velocity is in the future. So you have equations like this for all the major parameters. And this is how we do numerical weather prediction. Okay, we have a series of equations like this. It's that easy, maybe. Well, this has gotten good. I mean, faster computers, you know, better skill. Anyway, if this is a national, this is an official National Weather Service chart here that shows you the change in skill from 1950 to 2000, and the basic thing is the error has dropped a lot. The Weather Service has a lot of chutzpah down there. They call this a perfect forecast, and they claim that they're there. Well, I don't know about that, but and this is for flow at about 18,000 feet above the surface. So I don't know. I don't know if I'd call them perfect, but they've gotten a lot better, a lot better. Well, this is we're talking about water in this class here, right? So let's talk about water. I'm going to show you how things have changed. Okay, 1995. For the young guys, people here, that seems like a long time ago. For others of us, it's not so long ago. This is the National Weather. This was the state-of-the-art precipitation prediction, graphic. Back in 1995, this is from a model called the NGM, Nested Grid Model, and at that time the grid spacing was 80 kilometers. That means the distance between those grid points were 80 kilometers, okay? Which is not very good. And this is a precipitation forecast of a front coming into the Washington coast, right? Do you see where you see at the west coast is over here, right? You got that? And, there's not a lot of information, there's not a lot, you know. There's some heavy precipitation there, but there's not a lot of information there. Okay, that's, where's the mountains? The computer models there didn't do the mountains pretty much. Not good. Here's a blow-up. Okay, look at all the details of the precipitation around here, right? That's 1995. Let's go to 2001. It's like a space odyssey here, right? It's increased to 22-kilometer resolution. All right, well, a little bit better. This is a storm coming in. Well, here's Washington, Oregon. Well, a little bit more structure, but it's still not good enough. This is what 12 kilometers looks like. This is what we're running computer models here at the University of Washington. This is a 12-kilometer grid spacing. This is what the Weather Service has right now. And the story changes. Look at this. Hey, the winds were from the southwest. Can you see where you are? Okay, right here's Olympic Peninsula. On the windward side, look at all the heavy precipitation there. This is 3-hour precipitation. That's between 1.28 and 2.56 inches. And look at the rain shadow. Windward side precipitation drying the lee of the Cascades. All of a sudden, we start getting things. And what we found, one of the great things we found during the late 1990s, is when you got to around 12-kilometer grid spacing, we started getting the major precipitation structures here in the Northwest. A tremendous advance, okay? You guys don't look that impressed, but that's what I want, It was a tremendous advance. Now, I'm not saying this was perfect, but we started getting these structures. And here's 4 kilometers. We run that at the University of Washington right now. The Weather Service hasn't caught up to us yet. But 4 kilometers, you start getting a lot of the same structures, but you start getting, even in some of the individual drainages, you start seeing the effects of that, okay? And here's something we just started last week. This is really hot off the press. 1.3-kilometer grid spacing. Now, this is something the Weather Service is not going to be doing for probably 5 years over the whole United States. But here we can see details and individual drainages. The structures are just really amazing. So this is what we're going to, okay? The computer's getting faster and faster. We're getting the ability to do finer and finer resolution, okay? So that's a big story here. Just to give you, now I want to wow you, okay? Yeah, you weren't wowed enough. I want to show you a specific example. Remember I told you about the convergence zone, okay? You're all convergence zone experts, right? Here's a radar image of a convergence zone. This was back a few years ago. Here's this band of precipitation. The air was coming around here, converging right there. Okay, there was also some wind precipitation on the windward side of the Cascades. I'm sure there was precipitation here, but we can't see it because we don't have the radar. Here is 36-kilometer resolution, 36-kilometer grid spacing. This is going back in the 1990s. Where's the convergence zone? It doesn't exist. Where's the precipitation on the windward side of the elliptics? It's not there. The windward precipitation, it's lousy. This, and that's 4-kilometer resolution. That is pretty amazing. Look at that. It's almost perfect. Should just show, I'll do that again. 36, 4. Okay, now that's all, okay? Observations 36, 4, okay? So what I want to impress you with is one thing, we've really come very, very far now. We're getting to these details, okay? With higher resolution. And also the models have gotten better, too. So, as I said, these forecasts are quite good, but I don't want to make you think that there aren't problems. It's imperfect. Sometimes there's deficiencies in the initialization, especially since we're initializing over the Pacific, right? There's not as many observations over the Pacific as we like. And sometimes we don't start off very well, and that screws up the forecast. The other thing is there's also problems with the physics of the models. And what I mean by the physics, we have equations that describe how clouds work, how clouds change the precipitation, all that stuff. And these are not as good as they should be. They're better than they were, but they're not perfect. So that causes some problems. But there's another problem here. And the way that my field has given you forecasts has in some sense been dishonest and deceiving. Because, and you see this deception on TV weather every single day. Up until recently, all we did would do, we'd do one forecast. We put all our computer power to do one forecast as well as we could. And we'd say, this is the answer. But that is ridiculous because there's uncertainty in the forecast. There's uncertainty in the initial conditions. We should never give you, this is the forecast, because there's uncertainty there. We should always tell you the uncertainty of the forecast. And in fact, when you watch TV, right, and I don't want to pick up any TV person particular. Let's say take Jeff Renner, okay? Sometimes they show a 7-day or a 10-day forecast, and they give you an exact value, right? The temperature next Thursday the high is going to be 73 degrees, and the low is going to be this. What's the chances it'll be exactly that number, you know? Not much, right? We can't give you a single number. It's not fair. It's not right. What we have to do is give you probabilities. We have to give you the range of possibilities and tell you what's most probable. And we have been developing, during the last 10 years or so, the technology to do this. And this is what we call probabilistic prediction, a precipitation and everything else. And what we use is something called ensembles. Well, we have so much computer power now that we can not only do one simulation, we can do a dozen simulations, we can do 50 simulations, we can do 100 simulations. And what we do is each one of these simulations, we start with slightly different initial conditions, all reasonable, right? And then we can try all different physics, all reasonable. And we can end up with 50 or 100 forecasts. And with that, we can get probabilities. For instance, if half the forecasts give rain and half of them don't, what's the chance of rain? 50%. But we can do much more than that. You can say, what's the chances of having more than a tenth of an inch or a half an inch or whatever? We can give you probabilities now by using this ensemble approach. Anyway, it's a little more complicated than that, but that's the basics of it. Well, we've been running an ensemble system here at the UW. The Weather Service is running one now as well. And this is an example of an ensemble of forecasts, okay? And they're all a little different. Can you see they're all a little different? This is precipitation. Here's one. I took this off last night. This is a forecast, and I can't read the numbers. I think this is 48-hour forecast. I think for some time in the near future, and you can see they're all a little different, right? This is precipitation. Sorry, I can't read it myself. Well, we can create fun things like this. Like here is the probability of precipitation. Of 12-hour precipitation. This is a 40-hour forecast for 12-hour precipitation. And this I can read. This is valid. You know, this is this was a forecast starting Monday morning at 12 GMT, which is 4 o'clock in the morning, valid for the 12 hours ending Wednesday at 4 a.m. And what I want you to see is these are probabilities. The reds are 90% or more. The yellows are 70 to 90%. You see what we can do? And I could do probabilities like this for any amount, 1/10 of an inch, 1/2 an inch. This is what we can. We have the capability to do now. Now the question is, what do we do with this stuff? Once we have these probabilities, are you and are the users ready to use this stuff? Now, they should be using this stuff, but will they? Here's another fun one. I think this is a probability of more than a quarter of an inch, and this is for a period ending. I forgot when the period was, but you get the idea. Okay, that's another one. So anyway, so you get the idea. Forecasting technology, higher and higher resolution was the first thing we did. Second thing was this ensemble business that allows us to get probability. So that's the weather forecasting side of the business of water, okay? Well, what's the ultimate forecast? That's forecasting not 48 hours or 72 hours, but to forecast 100 years, okay? What's going to happen with precipitation under global warming? And I wanted to touch on that as well. And one thing people ask is how in the hell can you try to forecast what's going to happen 50 to 100 years from now if you can't forecast precipitation next week, right? That's a fair question, right? I don't know if I want to answer it either. but the truth is we're trying to do completely different things. When I'm forecasting precipitation for 3 or 4 days from now, what am I trying to forecast? I'm trying to forecast it's going to rain this amount at this time at this location, right? That's what weather forecasting is about, specificity. But when we do climate forecasting, we're not doing that. We're trying to say, well, what do we expect the average precipitation over this region going to be, you know, over a whole month or something? We're forecasting average or climate type stuff. We're not forecasting this is what's going to happen on that day. It's a very, very different forecasting problem. So let's talk a little bit about global warming and what will be the effects on the Pacific Northwest. And one thing I want to tell you, there is amazing hype going around about this stuff, about the effects of local effects of global warming. And the hype is on both sides, okay? So there are people who say, you know, this, we don't have to worry about it. It's all natural cycles. And then there are people saying that all these terrible things are going to happen, and all these terrible things have happened. I mean, how many times have you read in the paper that they say that there's going to be much more extreme precipitation in the Northwest under global warming? I mean, anybody have heard that one? Some people have heard it. There's no basis for that. Zero. And I want to talk about that. Well, you all know about global warming, right? So I'm not going to give you a global warming talk. But you all know the issue. Greenhouse gases are increasing. And we understand what greenhouse gases do. Here's CO2, that's going to go up, you know, depending on, you know, what we do, we either go up like that or like that. We know that. And we understand that there's going to be warming effects over the planet as a whole. And we also know, because the planet is warming, there'll be more moisture in the atmosphere, because if you warm up the oceans, you're going to put more moisture, and you warm up the atmosphere, there's going to be more moisture in the atmosphere. So overall, there's going to be more moisture in the atmosphere. We know that. So how do we forecast the future? Well, I've told you all about weather forecasting models. We basically use the same technology, okay? We basically use weather forecasting models, but lower resolution models, because we can't afford to run the same resolution. The weather forecasting models, we run at 12-kilometer resolution now we can run that out, you know, maybe a week. But the climate models are basically the same models that we run not at a 12-kilometer resolution, but at 150 or 200-kilometer resolution. And those are the better ones, okay? Because we can't afford it. We can't. Actually, the amount of computer power you need goes up roughly with a cube of the resolution. If you double the resolution, you need 8 times more processing power, which is interesting. Anyway, so basically, they're the same models, but the greenhouse gases are allowed to change in time, right? You need that. And the models we use are not only atmospheric models, but we also have ocean models running at the same time. So we have coupled atmosphere-ocean models, because you have to simulate the ocean as well. And it's similar equations. And there are a lot of uncertainties here. I mean, there's uncertainties in the physics, which I told you before. There's uncertainties in how much fossil fuel we're going to be burning, right? There's all these uncertainties that are there. But we do this anyway. Now, many of you have seen these global warming simulations or some of the results of it. And this is an example for temperature, and which I guess I could talk about briefly. But this is the A2 scenario. This is one where in which we keep on doing what we've been doing, right? This is like, you know, mankind doesn't change its ways, okay? So some people think that this is going to be a severe, relatively severe scenario of fossil fuel use. However, it turns out that, you know, the fossil fuel use is still going up really fast. So this may actually be pretty realistic. And what this shows you is the change in temperature over the planet. And this is for the year 2100, and this is from one of the better JCMs, general circulation models. These are temperature changes in degrees centigrade. That's 10 degrees, that red over there. Double that roughly for Fahrenheit, right? So what almost all the models show is the Arctic warms up more than any place else. The continents warm up more than the oceans. And interestingly enough, the eastern oceans warm up less than the western oceans. Now, there's one cute angle about that, is that we are downstream of an eastern ocean. Our weather is controlled by an eastern ocean. So it turns out that global warming effects will be less here and delayed compared to most places. We're actually one of the best locations for global warming stuff. So it's going to affect us here less than any place else, practically, except for one vulnerability, and that's our snowpack. We use the snowpack for a big water source here. And the fact that the global warming will cause the snowpack to lessen significantly by the end of the century. Another thing these GCMs indicate, particularly around here, is that the change is going to be kind of exponential. Not so much 2020s, but the second half of the century, it really takes off, even here. There have been a number of run like 20 different general circulation models. And I'm just going to, and they give you ranges of precipitation. This is precipitation over our region here. This shows you the variability of the models in terms of, you know, the observed period over here. Here's observations. And this shows you the variability of the models as we go into the next century. And this is the A1B scenario. That's sort of one that's on the low end. That's the middle end. The B1 is low end. But what I want you to see is that it's not draconian. That the precipitation doesn't change that rapidly over the region. Maybe it increases a little bit towards the end. But one thing we're not expecting is a huge change in precipitation around here. Here's another example. This is from the Climate Impacts Group work. And I'm just going to look at this winter one over here. This shows you winter precipitation. This is longitude over here, you know, crossing the West Coast. But what I want, these two dash lines here are two major general circulation models, and this shows you the change in precipitation over the century, and, you know, there's negatives and positives here. This is all close to zero. It's probably hard for you to see, but the GCMs don't show a major change in precipitation. But let me show you something that shows you more clearly. Graphics are always better, so let's do that. I'm going to show you, this is the ECM GCM, ECM 5 is one of the best GCMs for around here. And I'm going to show you what this general circulation model shows you for December, January, February precipitation. The red indicates, these are changes, I'm showing you 1995 to 2025. Red shows you decreases and blues are increases. So what is this showing during the winter? Slight decrease. And okay, this is September, October, November. Okay, this is in the fall. So what we're seeing is, you know, maybe a little bit of increase here in the fall. This is mainly November. And here's the total precipitation between 1990s and 2020s, and you can see it's not very large. A little bit of enhancement on the mountains here, a little drop over here, but you know, there's not a huge change in this GCM. Through that period. Through the 2050s, well, maybe a little increase here, decrease over there. This is annual precipitation. 1990s to 2020s, the 2090s, I mean, a little bit of a decrease here, increase up here. I mean, I can go through a lot of these things, but, you know, this is total precipitation, 1990s, 2020s, decrease. You know, that it's all over the place. This is 1990 to 2090s for December, January, February. Actually, a decrease in the winter here. So basically, the precipitation, I'm not going to go through all these things, are all over the place. There is almost all the GCMs don't show major changes in precipitation over the Northwest. If there is an increase, it tends to be a little bit further north of us in British Columbia. The winter precipitation seems to be down. The November rainfall seems to be up. And there's just huge uncertainties in these predictions. There's no real general agreement. The only thing we know for sure is almost all the GCMs indicate that the freezing level is moving up. So a higher percentage of the precipitation will probably be in rain, and the snow levels will rise in the mountains, which means there'll be less snowpack. Now, one thing, I want to get back to the extreme precipitation. Changes in extreme precipitation are highly uncertain. We are really not sure about that. One of the things we've done at the university here, the department here, is we ran high-resolution computer simulations of what's going to happen in the next century. And I want to show you what it showed for heavy precipitation at SeaTac Airport. This is the number of days per decade of precipitation greater than 2 centimeters at SeaTac. And here's 1990s, 2020s, 50s, 2090s. Well, you know, maybe it's up slightly, but it really is no huge increase in the number of extreme precipitation days. In fact, you know, it's actually possible the number of extreme days could decrease. I told you about the Pineapple Express and atmospheric rivers. Well, those are very closely associated with the jet stream. Most of these general circulation models indicate that the jet stream is going to move northward during the next 50-100 years. So it is possible that these Pineapple Expresses may actually move northward more, and we may actually get less extreme precipitation. And it's interesting to note that if you look over the last 30-50 years, Oregon has gotten less extreme precipitation. It's decreased there, while it's increased a little bit up here. So all I'm saying is this is no slam dunk. We really don't know now what's going to happen to extreme precipitation around here. It's a little bit early to tell. So anyway, I'm going to end the talk right here with this, and I'd like to leave a lot of time for questions. So I'm going to stop right now, and I'm going to open it up to the group. Okay? So thank you. Questions? And there must be questions. Yes?
How does rising sea level affect these models?
In terms of affecting precipitation?
Yeah.
Or saying, no, that has very little effect. No, that's not going to have much effect at all. Other questions? Yes?
So, as I understand it, warmer air, we're going to get warmer air with more moisture, so we'd expect more precipitation as a result, but you're suggesting that there isn't likely to be so. What is unique about Pacific Northwest weather patterns that don't cause that? Because I've read throughout the United States that is a trend going up.
You know, if you look at a map of changes in precipitation, and especially change in extreme precipitation, you can see there's a tremendous increase in the Midwest, and it seems to be associated with convective storms. Now, around here, you know, amount of moisture in the atmosphere is not the only reason you get precipitation. I mean, you need things like Pineapple Express coming in, or you need weather systems. So exactly where that jet stream is and where these disturbances are have a big, big impact. I mean, how strong that flow is coming into us, that has a big impact. So it's not only the raw amount of moisture in the atmosphere. A lot of other things come into play. So what we've seen in these simulations is November seems to be up a bit. And that's there, but the whole winter is not, because the rest of the winter is a little bit drier. And I don't think we understand, you know, exactly why this is. This is the kind of thing we have to unravel. But at this point, there's no real evidence that we're going to have a massive increase of extreme precipitation, like the Pineapple Express stuff. If the jet stream moves north and those Pineapple Expresses move north, I mean, you know, it's warmer down in California, but they don't get more precipitation than we do, right? We, you know, we could have the Californication of our area. In fact, you know, in terms of talk about moisture, these computer simulations indicate that we're going to have more clouds in the spring, in early summer, under global warming than we have now. We're going to become more like California, right? If you're on the coast of California, it's lousy to be there in the summer, right? And because what happens is the interior of the continent warms up, and it's the pressure falls because of that, and there's more of an onshore pressure difference, and that pushes the clouds in. That could happen here. So we could end up with more lousy spring days under global warming here. That's one indication of some of these simulations. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Can you explain why the eastern oceans aren't going to warm as much as western sides of the ocean?
You know, I can't. I've asked my oceanographer friends, and they say, oh, yeah, yeah. And then they gave me these explanations, but I wouldn't want to repeat them right now. But they said, oh, yeah, it's obvious. But and I don't understand why, but that is something that is extremely robust in these simulations, that the eastern oceans don't warm up as much. They were talking to me something about the mixed layers in the oceans and the difference between and the stabilities between the western and eastern oceans, but I don't even want to try it because I'm going to get it wrong. But that is a very robust finding. So that's one thing you don't hear too much in the popular press, the fact that we are in this favorable location, that thing that because of that, the warming is delayed. In fact, interestingly enough, if you look at the temperatures of the air coming in off the ocean over the last 30 years, it hasn't warmed up in 30 years. The last 30 years, the air coming in has not warmed up coming into the Northwest. If you look at the snowpack in the Cascades, you know, there's been all kinds of talks about snowpack disappearing. The snowpack in the Cascades has not changed in the last 30, 35 years. And that's consistent with the fact that temperatures haven't changed. So we got to be really, really careful before we sort of make a scare story here about things. Yeah?
And isn't that the real impact for the Northwest, is the change in the snowpack because of the temperature increases? So, you know, I've seen talks from the NAFTA that show the areas that were snow-dominated systems transitioning to
right.
transitional systems.
Right.
Right,
that is going to be the big impact. So the temperature, so around here, let's face it, no one's going to complain if it's a little bit warmer, right? And if the weather gets a little nicer here, you know, that's not going to be a big deal. The big problem here is the fact that we store a lot of our water in the snowpack, and we're dependent on it. And the snowpack, by the end of the century, is going to be a lot less. We're talking about in the order of 40% less snowpack by the end of the century. Where, you know, some of the younger people in this crowd are probably going to live to see this, you know? And so that's a big impact. Now, we're going to have the same amount of water. Now, I guess, you know, if I was unecological, I probably shouldn't say that in this room. But, if, you know, we're going to have the water. If we could store the water, we'd be okay. If you want to build more dams, right? If you don't worry about the salmon so much, or you build big reservoirs in eastern Washington, we could store the water. The water will be here. It's just that we won't have the snowpack. The snowpack will be a lot. So, you know, skiing in Snoqualmie Pass will not happen after 2050. I can almost guarantee you that. Because how marginal it is. Other questions? Yes, in the back.
One of the phenomena I noticed in the last 15 years in the popular press has been trying to put the El Nino or La Nina stamp on everything and then put the weather in kind of a box. And I'm wondering what your feelings are specifically as you're watching the ocean temperatures right now about trying to categorize the winter using those two or three really.
Right. Well, oh, yeah. Well, it's the only thing we got. See, the thing is, I mean, how far in the future can you believe weather forecasts of precipitation or anything else, okay? Basically, you know, 1 or 2 days, we're really good. 3 or 4 days is quite a bit of skill. 5 or 6 days, it's fading. By the time you get to 7 days or 8 days, it's going down fast, okay? So it's almost like climatology, right? So 2 weeks out, we basically don't have any forecast skill. Okay, using these computer models. And this is all chaos theory. You probably all know about chaos and that kind of stuff. Anyway, so how do we forecast further than that? The only thing we have that gives us even the slightest bit of skill seasonally is this El Niño, La Niña business that you're talking about, right? I mean, you all know what El Niño and La Niña is, right? El Niño is warmer than normal sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific. La Niña is colder than normal. And there is a connection between what happens in the tropical Pacific and what happens up here. El Niño years tend to be somewhat drier and a little bit warmer here in the Northwest. One thing that's really robust, it tends to be less snow. Less snow in the lowlands, which is good for the mayor. I guess he was not mayor anymore. And less snow in the mountains. So that's the most robust connection for us. On the other hand, California gets more precipitation El Niño years. But this is a correlation. It's not perfectly predictive, which is very important. La Niña years, we tend to have more snow. So I look at that. That's the only thing we have. So if you're a betting person, you would say that the snowpack, the chances of having a snowy December like we had last year is much, much less this year because we have an El Niño. And the chances of having a really heavy snowpack in the Cascades is less. One thing to keep in mind, that correlation of El Niño and La Niña tends to fade out after roughly, it tends to be weak before January 1st. The main correlation is after January 1st. So that's that phenomenon. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I've heard that the frequency of oscillations between El Niño and La Niña years has become more frequent. Is that true because of global warming, or is that?
I haven't heard that, so I can't comment on that. It's typically 4 to 7 years is the typical. But, you know, even our ability to predict it is very, very poor. I mean, last year was a good example. Last year, we were completely bamboozled by the whole business. In September, authoritative meteorologists were saying, well, this is a neutral year. Okay, this is going to be a neutral year. That's neither El Niño or La Niña. Then, completely unforecast, it switched to a La Niña in December. And then we had all that snow going on. So it just shows you our ability even to forecast it is poor. Yes.
And is there any way that you have enough data on past conditions that you could test your model to see if they predict correctly?
Right, so the question is about testing our models on past conditions. And we do that very, very much. I mean, for instance, the weather forecasting models, we're always testing it on past conditions. I mean, we're always looking at it and verifying it. The climate models, the GCMs, they actually have run these models starting at 1900 and running it through the century. And what we find is with the current generation of general circulation models, climate models, driven by variations in the sun that we know were occurring at the time, and by dust from volcanic eruptions and all this stuff that you know we know that was going on, we force that into our models, and they actually duplicate the temperature variations of last century pretty well. So that gives us some confidence these models are useful. But I'll tell you, somebody who knows what's under the hood, these models have their problems. I mean, they have the jet streams are often in the wrong places. There's often errors in these models that are still there. These models are still highly imperfect. That's why we have to be careful. Other questions? Yes. What will happen after 100 years? Well, it all depends. Some of the models have been run further than that. Most of the time we stop at 2100, but it's all radically dependent upon what we do with our fossil fuel use. And then also what happens to the Greenland ice and the Antarctic ice. So I think there's tremendous uncertainties at that point. So I wouldn't even want to speculate on that. Other questions? Yes?
Are the predictions of your latest high resolution model available online now?
Well, 4 kilometers is online right now. I'll even show it to you. But the really high resolution will be going online very, very shortly, probably next week. It'll be available, a little more delayed than the other ones. If anybody ever wants to see this stuff, okay. See, does this work? Nah, come on. I thought. Don't you got University of Washington stuff here? University of Washington Network. What's this? Marsian. Is that open? Okay, let's see if that works. Nah. Well, all this stuff is online. Oh yeah, there it is. Okay. That's pretty good. If you ever want to see this stuff, just go here, Pacific Northwest Environmental Modeling and Observations. Okay, so I can go right now. This just shows you how much fun this is. You can go to 12. I'll go to 12 kilometers, and I can go down to precipitation. So I mean, this is what the real hardcore stuff looks like. And I'm going to go 12 kilometers. So there's snow, and I'll do Western Washington. Western Washington 3 hour precipitation. I'll do that. I mean, this is how we forecast. So, for instance, if I want to forecast what's going to happen today, okay, that's a 12. These are 3 hour. This is the 3 hour precipitation ending at various times. You can see the time up here. Okay, that's 1 o'clock today. So I want you to watch that. Okay. Done. So it shows these showers coming in, and then precipitation in the mountains, us getting rain shadowed a bit. And then I can go to the next system coming in. I'm going into the future. See how we can do it? It's easy to be a meteorologist. These computer models tell you how much precipitation is going to be. So this is what the technology looks like. And this is 12 kilometers. Then we have 4 online, and the 1.3 will be online too. Other questions?
You have time for one more.
The global warming simulation, the North Pole is heating up a lot
rapidly. Right. Well, there's a few reasons. One of the reasons is the North Pole, or the Arctic area, now has a lot of snow and ice. And where snow and ice reflects a lot of solar radiation, has a high albedo. And so that keeps it cool, right? Because, you know, you go skiing, right? You have to wear sunglasses, right? So what happens if you start melting it back? Well, the places where the sun would have been reflected off into space now gets absorbed by the water and warms up more. That melts more ice, which causes more sun to be absorbed, and so you get this feedback. Another reason is radiative, the fact that the air in the Arctic region tends to be relatively cold and dry, and if you add, and CO2 is a good greenhouse gas, and that acts as a blanket. So water is the ultimate greenhouse gas. But so now we bring CO2, and so the place that really was the driest air is the one that will have the most radiative effect. So there's a few reasons that cause the Arctic to be the place. Okay.